Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as hoofing it up to Johnny Walters.
Okay, Joe Malloy here, Nathan Murphy here. Football show coming at you. We have Dermot Corrigan from Madrid joining us to tell us about, well, Zinedine Zidane, it turns out, is a very good manager. We need to just accept this and move on. He has turned the ship around at Real Madrid with no new players, effectively. They beat Atletico at the weekend 1-0. They're 3 points clear, top of La Liga. They are defensively brilliant, solid, everybody working very hard. And Manchester City, they're coming at you.
Yeah, it is really interesting how he's managed to turn it round. Suddenly Karim Benzema is in the form of his life, mm-hmm. a real leader in this team. Has kind of done it as well without Luka Modric being the best midfielder in world football. Yeah. Has been able to rotate him a little bit. And the young players who have come through, who, whenever players come through Real Madrid at 17, 18, you wonder how long it's going to last, but they do look like they're the real deal. And so many of those players have 3-4 Champions League medals at this stage. Like, it is going to be that clash of this sort of fabled European experience that Manchester City don't have, that Paris Saint-Germain don't have, that you go out at the same stage every season. That is there something about European football somehow City don't know? Some dirty tricks that Real Madrid are just well aware of.
You would think Pep would have told them by now. Mm. But here we are. So Dermot Corrigan's going to fill us in, and also what's going to happen to Diego Simeone. Atletico effectively acid stripped, the team anyway, whatever about the stadium, which is magnificent. The team acid stripped, and Simeone is, well, humming and hawing to a point. He is the highest paid manager in world football, which is a compensation of sorts, i.e. financial. But not in great shape at the moment. They are 13 points off Real Madrid. So that is on the way. In the meantime, you mentioned the kids there at Real Madrid, the kids at Liverpool, nil all against Shrewsbury. Now, excitingly, it's halftime.
Yes.
So, for all we know, Jurgen Klopp is currently speaking via speakerphone to the dressing room.
Probably asking why this game involving the European champions and the runaway Premier League leaders can't be found anywhere on television, anywhere in the world, it seems.
Well, it's on his laptop, so the word is it's been connected to his laptop via LFC TV, their live feed. This was Neil Critchley talking today. He said that when this happened against Aston Villa, wasn't it, in the League Cup, that Klopp spoke to the team at halftime, so they're expecting the same again. Shrewsbury, by the way, are not pleased because Liverpool have sold their entire allocation of tickets, reduced to £15 for adults, £1 for juniors tonight into that game. So they reckon it's cost Shrewsbury, a League One club, over €500,000.
Well, also, the BBC are currently showing Newcastle against Oxford.
2-0 Newcastle, we should say.
I would imagine that the BBC would have been showing Liverpool if it was a full strength Liverpool. But obviously took Jurgen Klopp at his word and thought, there's going to be no giant killing here. No. And if there is, it won't be of any interest.
The newspaper I was reading today, excuse me, I forget which one it was, but it was going through managers who've missed other games, included Alex Ferguson when his son was getting married in South Africa. He was in Cape Town. But Edgar Davids of Barnet was the one. So as part of his contract, the reports go, he had a clause which meant if there was an overnight stay required beforehand, then he didn't have to be manager that day. That's how desperate Barnet were to have Edgar Davids, which was a classic one. And then Neil Warnock at Leeds United, he was sick one night, Leeds at Elland Road against Birmingham City. So he listened on the radio, and then at half time he got on the phone and gave instructions as to what should happen. So there we are. There is precedent, Nathan. That's all I'm saying. There's precedence here for Jurgen Klopp.
But there were reasons behind all of those.
Oh, I know.
Like, Edgar Davids is a superstar.
Yeah.
How can he be expected to do such things? Like, Barnet are probably going to be staying at a Holiday Inn. He's thinking, not really for me. Alex Ferguson was a strange situation where his son was getting married and they had arranged for the wedding to be during an international break. And then they changed the international break, played all the games midweek, and there was a full round of Premier League games at the weekend.
It's hard to change a wedding in South Africa at short notice.
Well, how committed are you to the cause?
Yeah.
You know? You're a manager of Manchester United. But there's no reason Jurgen Klopp shouldn't be there. Maybe he has sat down with Michael Edwards. He's sat down with the ownership. They've looked at how this season has gone. One of the great seasons. He said, I'm at my best when I can recharge my batteries. I'm mentally destroyed. Mm-hmm. We've been all over the world. I've given absolutely everything to this. I'm going to switch off for 3 or 4 days. I'm going to come back better than ever.
He has leverage right now. There's not much they can say.
It just seems There's no question it's disrespectful. It's absolutely disrespectful.
Well, we are where we are. Liverpool 0, Shrewsbury 10 0. Derby County 3-1 up in Northampton. I know you're eagerly awaiting that result.
Well, Derby Cardiff play Manchester United.
Who do?
Derby play Manchester United in the next round.
Okay.
Which will be Wayne Rooney taking on Manchester United, where apparently he did quite well once upon a time.
Yeah. Cardiff are 2-0 up in Reading, and it's Birmingham City 0, Coventry City 1 after an hour.
Interesting thing about that, Joe.
Go on.
The first game was played at St Andrews, and the replays played at St Andrews, because they both played St Andrews.
Some of the narratives here.
These are the big talking points that get you going on a Tuesday night.
Oh, I can't believe we're still here. So, West Ham. I want to ask you about this, because I still haven't been to this stadium. So I thought this was interesting in the midst of what is a crisis on the field. David Moyes does not seem to have been able to turn this thing around. Even Pat Nevin, who's very friendly with David Moyes last night, was saying, look, it's going to be really tough. They have Liverpool and Man City on the way. I think Southampton is a winnable game. And then they have a glut of other really tough games. So things are not looking good for West Ham. But they have confirmed plans to install 2 new tiers of seats closer to the pitch. So basically, as we know, the West Ham fans hate the stadium in pretty much every way. It detracts from the atmosphere. So the club has said two new lower tier stands that will bring fans closer to the pitch, many by more than 4 metres. And then, interestingly as well, and I think this is a good point, along with the stand being squared off in line with the more traditional football stadium configuration behind the goals. Because it is always a strange one when you see that circle oval shaped London Stadium there. So, you know, it's something. Supporters have been giving out as well, it's the distance between the seats and the pitch way too big. Transport to the stadium is bad. Toilet and catering facilities in some areas not satisfactory. The whole thing seems to be a bit of a mess. Is this ground as bad as they're all making out when you're there?
Yes. So, I think we both experienced the Olympic Stadium in London 2012.
Yeah.
And the atmosphere was just electric. Like, the one thing you remember was this sort of Mexican wave of noise as the athletes would go around the track. Mm. And
it's funny, actually, now that you mentioned it, being there, I never thought too much about the green part in the middle. It was very far away, I wasn't too bothered with it. You're looking at the track, you know.
Except like, then the javelin is on when
you're... You're watching
the big screen.
Usain Bolt's run the 100 metres. Mm.
And the first time I was back then was 2015 World Cup. Ireland played Italy there at the Rugby World Cup. And I was sat in the commentary box, and you're a million miles away from the pitch. And when you're watching a rugby match at the best of times, and there's a scrum over on the far side in the corner, not a clue what was going on. And I was thinking, there's no way this is going to stay like this for when West Ham arrive. You couldn't watch a football match in this sort of arena. And sure enough, back opening weekend, it's the exact same. Mm. From the top tier, the distance to the far wing, I'm sure is the furthest distance of any team in the Premier League.
Okay, so that's not going to be fixed by these lower tiers.
Hard to see how it can be. But then there's the added problem of, if you're on those lower tiers, you're down at ground level, that it's impossible to get any real sense of where players are on the pitch because you're so far back. They've obviously figured out some sort of a way of improving this. Aesthetically, I wonder how it'll look. Maybe they don't care at this stage. Maybe they just want to appease the supporters who obviously were sold this dream of this brilliant new stadium and have been sold a bit of a dud. But what is West Ham? West Ham are a mid-table team. That's where they want to be. Mm. It's where they're always going to be. Mm. They're never going to be a Champions League outfit unless Saudi billionaires come in and buy the club. They are hit and miss in the transfer market. They spend money ridiculous ways. They have huge wage bills. They've talented players there, like Issa Diop at centre-back is somebody you could see ending up at a big club. Anderson in midfield is brilliant at times. They end up with the odd striker here and there who'll score a few goals. But you also even get the sense... Like they've no great history of success, despite the West Ham way, like FA Cups and when the 80s. That they, you know, their supporters like to be the underdog of, you know, we're not Tottenham, we're not Arsenal, we're not Chelsea. Mm. You know, we're rough and ready. Mm. Whereas actually putting them in this plush surrounding of, well, you know, we're a bit more cosmopolitan, we're just like those guys. It's not really West Ham.
Hasn't quite fit.
No. Like, all right, you don't want to go back to some of the bad stuff of the 80s, but you can still have a bit of an edge in the ground. Mm. You still have a bit of an atmosphere where it's not nice for visiting supporters. Like, that's the nicest trip. You can go in shopping in Stratford in the shopping centre for an hour before the match. Mm. any amount of nice restaurants when you step outside. That's not West Ham. Mm.
No, it's true. Well, they're trying to sort out the situation, but it does seem like they're just stuck with it. And most likely, I mean, they kind of, like, if you look at the table now, so...
Well, they're third from bottom.
In the relegation
zone.
You would
wonder.
With a tough run of fixtures coming up. They're going to lose their next two, Liverpool and Man City next up.
And you would have to wonder what would happen to that club if they were relegated. Because everything over the last 4 years since they moved into that stadium is, we're looking up. We're no longer going to be a yo-yo club.
Yeah.
We're a team that'll be fighting for Europe and contending in Europe.
Well, the Di Canio team that went down was far superior to this one, so it's very possible.
And it is hard right now to see who's going to score the goals. They just signed Jared Bowen from Hull, who's been scoring goals in the Championship. But West Ham's history is littered with strikers who scored goals in the Championship who didn't step up. Robert Snodgrass has a bit of quality. Like, Lanzini's constantly been injured. Yarmolenko's constantly been injured. There's definitely enough quality there compared to some of the sides around them. But it's just so toxic. Like, David Moyes doesn't seem to inspire confidence anywhere. Mm. And I know when he came initially, there was talk of, we're going about things differently now in the transfer market. We're not going to go for those overpaid superstars. We're going to develop players. Like, all that goes out the window if they get relegated.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. I just wanted to mention something. I was reading a good piece in The Guardian today about PSG and Neymar and Mbappe. So initially I was looking into the Neymar situation because he's out of PSG's squad for their league match at Nantes tonight with a rib injury, but had found time to celebrate his 28th birthday. It was a big Parisian event, big nightclub. Thomas Tuchel, is it the best way to prepare for a match? No, clearly not. Is it the worst thing in the world? No. Neymar turned up all white, looking very dapper. And I thought, you know, it's just another Neymar ruling the club and not all that interested story. But it was more the Mbappe situation which then caught my eye. PSG, by the way, are on 55 points in the league. Marseille are on 43, so they're 12 points clear. Which by Premier League standards is positively a title race at this stage. But Mbappe, so 5-0 up against Montpellier at the weekend. Mbappe's already scored a goal. This is PSG's 9th game in 4 weeks. And they've got Borussia Dortmund on the horizon. So Thomas Tuchel decides to take Mbappe off. It was a good idea and it was necessary, said the piece I was reading for sure. So Mbappe is very frustrated walking off. He walks off, he tries to bypass Thomas Tuchel on the touchline. Tuchel then tries to reason with the player. And then Mbappe attempts to ignore him and then starts talking back. They have a little chat and then Mbappe walks towards the bench muttering to himself. And starts just, you know, waving his hand over his shoulder at Tuchel, kind of dismissing him. And then after the match, he refuses all requests for selfies or supporters, makes his way to his private box. Tuchel said the incident, not good. I'm not angry. I'm sad. Angel Di Maria says, there are boys on the bench who want to come on. He needs to get that. So there's just this sense that, I mean, this thing is coming to a head. And against Montpellier in December, Mbappe did the same thing. Completely ignored Tuchel. The obvious conclusion to draw is he's looking at Neymar, he's looking how this guy's going about his business. The same way people talk about the Manchester United dressing room lacking role models. He's got Neymar as his. But what was interesting was Adam White and Eric Devon in Get French Football News talked about Mbappe generally. So he sounds there like not a great fella. And you know, there's certain things he does which would feed into that. So he said, quote, he was now a superstar. Maybe you shouldn't say that about yourself. But they say he always comes across as a really good fella rather than the sulking youngster they saw at the weekend. So his Instagram account, for instance, shows him to be socially conscious. He talks about the Australian bushfire crisis, saving Amazon rainforests. He contributed €60,000 to help find the Nantes forward Salah and the pilot in that plane crash. So he gave €60,000 there. He donated all £275,000 of his match fees from France's World Cup 18 win to charity. And so they say, as a result, the darkening of his mood on the pitch is a little jarring. He's out of there is the kind of conclusion. And it mightn't be the worst thing if he gets out of there because PSG are just running away with the league every year. He's got Neymar hanging around. He's too powerful almost for PSG.
Well, he is the next on the list after Messi and Ronaldo.
Yeah.
So the opportunity is going to come up in the next couple of years to be the best player in the world. When you saw the footage initially, it's almost seemed like a Pep Guardiola with Raheem Sterling coming off the pitch and Sterling not happy and he's very much on his shoulders. But then you realise it's a totally different dynamic because
Guardiola was in charge.
Mbappe is the one with all the power here. And if Paris Saint-Germain get beaten by Borussia Dortmund next month or whoever, before a Champions League semi-final or final. He's gone. In fact, unless they win it, he's probably gone in the summer anyways. He's still only 21. And what he's done has been unbelievable. And every time you see him, like covering Paris Saint-Germain in some of their Champions League games this year, he came off the bench, scored a hat-trick in a match when like there was no real quality there at all. Like, you look at their midfield, it's not a Champions League winning midfield you would expect. He is the X factor, he's the star. And it did feel maybe it was a bit contrived of a, I need to just start ruffling a few feathers here, just to let people know that I'm not quite happy, that this isn't going to come out of the blue. You would still expect he'll end up at Real Madrid or Barcelona, but there's been an awful lot of speculation linking him with Liverpool over the last few months.
Right.
You haven't heard this?
No. I tend not to put too much stock in
no,
this.
No, and like the very fact that it's hard to, when was the last time, as great as the Premier League has become, a top five world player has moved to a Premier League club?
No, it's always Real Madrid.
Just doesn't
Barcelona.
Happen. It's always Real Madrid.
How much would he cost
Barcelona?
Liverpool?
Like you're talking 200 million. You would expect.
Yeah.
Which just doesn't seem to fit in. Maybe you sell Mo Salah in the summer for 150 and you get a 21-year-old who can do the next 5 years.
Would you get 150 for Mo? You get close to 100.
Like, oh, imagine trying to rule that Paris Saint-Germain dressing room where you have
Mbappe,
Neymar. They brought Icardi in during the summer, who everything we saw at Inter Milan was that he's a complete lunatic.
Yeah.
Had all sorts going on
off the
field.
Yeah.
Liked to party a little bit as well. Poor old Edinson Cavani just there as the good guy.
I know, not being allowed to do anything. Mm. So it's a nightmare for Tuchel. I mean, like you've got Neymar off to his birthday, not even thinking about rehabilitating. The last time he had a birthday, he took 2 days and missed training. And then you've Mbappe just starting to act out a little bit. So that's where PSG are at the moment.
Well, he's been trying to find a way as well to get all four of them into the team at times, because maybe he's just looked at this and thought, like defensively, all right, they've got Thiago Silva, Kimpembe. Maybe we can just about do enough, but in midfield, we've no quality. So let's get rid of some of them, go all out attack, and somehow pray to God that if we score four, the opposition will only score three.
Mm. So I was about to tell you Jurgen Klopp would be texting Neil Critchley furiously because they'd gone 1-0 up against Liverpool, but that goal has been ruled out. So it's still 0-0 there. And Newcastle are 2-0 up away to Oxford. One other story to bring people today. I'm interested to see how much traction this gets. Now, I dare say if there wasn't an election on and there was a quasi-permanent minister for sport, that minister would be asked about this and this might have the potential to become a trickier subject for the government. Basketball Ireland have come out and talked about the double standards that the FAI received money given their predicament, and that when Basketball Ireland were in a similar position back in 2008 when they went €1.5 million when they ran into financial difficulties, they were in a blacked out of hole, they say, and financial difficulties totaling €1.5 million. So they were in trouble back then. This is the Basketball Ireland statement today. So they've kind of put this out there in a big way. And their basic argument is, at our darkest time, a similar agreement to that which was awarded last week to the FAI would have considerably changed the trajectory of Basketball Ireland and would have proven to be a lifeline. Instead, he says, difficult period, no financial assistance, and forced to call an immediate halt to our international team programs and to make half of our employees redundant, which is fairly significant, obviously, and to reduce debt. Since then, Basketball Ireland has turned its position around completely, and on it goes to say, you know, we still haven't received full funding back to what it was cut from back in 08. Bernard O'Byrne here, formerly of the FAI, obviously, is now with Basketball Ireland. And so, you know, he in particular, you would think, has a foot in both camps and would have been watching events very closely. I mean, they have a point, of course they do. And you would like to say there's an endless pot of money for everything and you would just be absolutely fair to everyone in the country and every organisation in the country. Sadly, it's not the reality. It's the reality when you're trying to choose between the health service and prioritising another aspect of Irish life, which might feel hard done by comparison with the health service. I mean, like the interesting line that jumped out at me there is where he said the Basketball Ireland had to halt their international programmes. And I don't know the nitty-gritty of that, but like you probably just can't let that happen. If you're the government in 2020, you can't let the FAI fall into a position where the international fixtures or programs grind to a halt and you cause international embarrassment, and what? The team don't fulfill their fixtures? Like, it's rotten and it's not fair. And yet, I understand why they've certainly bailed out the FAI, even though they don't want to use that term. Whatever about the treatment of Basketball Ireland, that may be a point. Certainly their treatment of the FAI, if we're focusing on that initially, is hard to quibble with because the alternative was so horrific.
I think people are conflicted, though, about this bailout, whatever you want to call it, for the FAI. Basketball Ireland had to suffer for a decade because of what went on, whereas the FAI, it seems, are somehow, a year later, within a year, going to somehow emerge from this, which is brilliant in a lot of ways, because what's the alternative? As you say, worst case scenario, what do we want? 100 people to lose their jobs. And we go, great, that the FAI is sorted out, people have been punished.
League of Ireland goes.
Or you provide a way forward. It was maybe the celebratory tone, I think, that jarred with a lot of people last week. This is manna from heaven, a sort of, we're back, Irish football's back. Whereas a lot of people want to know, well, who's going to pay the price for this? Who ultimately is going to pay the price for this? And there's investigations obviously still ongoing, so people may well pay the price. But
In the meantime,
do we just all kick on out Irish football and pretend none of this ever happened? Maybe we do. Like, maybe that is what should happen. Maybe that was a time in the past and now we all kick on and are positive. But I think that jars with a lot of people.
It does, for sure. Absolutely. There's a lot of people who feel that they've got off scot-free here. We're going to take a short break. So Liverpool still nil all with Shrewsbury. Newcastle beating Oxford. Next up, Dermot Corrigan joins us from Madrid.
Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as hoofing it up to Johnny Walters.
Now, welcome back. So, Real Madrid are 3 points clear of Barcelona in La Liga after 22 games played. They beat Atletico in the Madrid derby over the weekend, 1-0 at the Bernabeu, courtesy of a Karim Benzema goal. Zinedine Zidane has well and truly righted the ship, it would seem. Dermot Corrigan of Independent Newspapers is with us in Madrid. How you doing?
Hey Joe, how's it going?
Great to have you with us. First league loss for Atletico at the Bernabeu in 7 years, no less. Kind of extraordinary to read that.
Yeah, Atletico have had a pretty good go of it under Simeone in recent years. They've really put it up to Madrid and matched them. Not so much in the Champions League, where they keep falling off just at the penalty shootout or extra time, wherever. But in La Liga, they've had an excellent record. But it ended at the weekend. Madrid were much the better team, especially in the second half. And Madrid are on the up now, whereas Atletico really look to be on the down at the moment.
I was reading a piece by your colleague Sid Lowe, and he was talking about the job that Zidane is doing at the moment. And he said, of their win and of their form generally, there is a seriousness about Madrid this season that means that while they may not always sparkle, there's a sense of invulnerability about them right now. They've played 4-4-2, they've played five in midfield, a man behind the forwards, three across the front. One thing that doesn't change, though, is a level of concentration and competitiveness and their physical condition too. And they're not conceding many goals, only 13 in 22 games. So it seems there is a bit of steel, actually, as opposed to razzmatazz about this team now.
Yeah, for sure. Like, when Zidane left last season, pretty much the team took the season off. You know, they had two different coaches with Lopetegui coming in first and then Solari. But they made, you know, awful mistakes, especially at the back, maybe symbolised by Sergio Ramos, who had a lot of slip-ups. His concentration wasn't good. Remember, he got himself booked against Ajax in the first leg because he wanted to miss the second leg, and then they got knocked out of the Champions League. And similar stuff was happening at the back for them all through the year. But since Zidane came back in last summer, he's really straightened them all out. Has everybody focused, everybody working hard. Even the forwards are working hard, and those who don't, like maybe Gareth Bale, are not in the team at the weekend. And yeah, 1-0 to Real Madrid. You know, the Bernabeu usually likes to see attacking football. It likes to see their team flying forward. It likes to see skill and flamboyance and taking risks, all that type of stuff. But Zidane has got everybody happy enough to go 1-0 up, then sit back and defend, make sure they don't make any mistakes at the back. And it's working for them so far.
And it's not being critiqued in the press or in the stands. They are happy enough to go with this approach.
Yeah, it is kind of strange. You know, it's because it's Zidane, I guess. If your name was Rafa Benitez or Julian Lopetegui, you'd have a lot more trouble trying to convince people that 1-0 in a game was enough, that you just get the 3 points and you move on to the next weekend. But because it's Zidane, and because last season was so bad, because there were so many embarrassments, losing, even in the summer, they lost 7-3 to Atletico in a in a friendly game, but even still, that was an embarrassment. The Ajax game, you've been beaten 5-0, 5-1 by Barcelona, all these type of results in recent years. So the fact that Zidane has come in and has got them tight, has got them running together, has got them winning games, is enough for him to have a pretty unassailable position at the moment. He can do whatever he wants, really.
Yeah, I do remember that 7-3 loss to Atletico about, what, 6-7 months ago now, and all the headlines, historic humiliation, a ragdoll thrown about by a hurricane. Simeone has taught Zidane a lesson, and his attitude, Zidane's attitude, that was everyone just stay calm here, and obviously things have turned out okay. It is an amazing thing, really, for those of us who still remember and cherish the memory almost of Zidane as a player. It is extraordinary that that player has become this manager.
Yeah, for sure. I think we remember a lot of Zidane as maybe from later on in his career, I do anyway, from when he was at the Bernabeu, and he would come up with these amazing bits of skill to win a game on his own, maybe, or with France, where he would pull them out of a difficult situation on his own. But as a coach, he seemed maybe to have been formed during his earlier years in Serie A at Juventus, when he had 3 years under Marcello Lippi there. And that was all about, you know, the structure of the team, building from the back, really Italian-style pragmatism approach to going about winning games. And that seems to be Zidane, the coach. Even when during his first spell, you know, early on in his time, he got the defence right. He put Casemiro in front of the back four. When the first time they won the Champions League, they drew nil-all against Man City. They won 1-0 with a deflected goal in the second leg. He was happy enough to find a way to win. That hasn't always gone down so well with some of the people around the club. Maybe Florentino Perez would prefer a more exciting style of football and keeps adding more attacking players. But Zidane, over time, has got the power to do what he wants. And at the moment, that is go 1-0 up and see out the game.
And he didn't bring in, I mean, unless I'm forgetting somebody very obvious here, obviously they were linked with Pogba during the summer. This is still last season's team. He wasn't allowed to add dramatically to the squad.
No, well, Eden Hazard was the big signing of the summer, but he's been injured a lot. You know, he's was out at the start. He missed the start of the season. Then he came back. I think he's only got 2 goals. Then he's been out again for the last 3 months or so. So it's easy enough to forget about him. And they have done it without him. They've found a way to win games. You know, Ramos has scored. Casemiro got 2 goals against Sevilla. Varane got 2 goals against Getafe. Danny Carvajal doesn't normally score. He's been scoring as well. So they haven't... they haven't got those, apart from Benzema, they don't have those big name attackers who are, you know, banging in the goals or who are going on solo runs, beating 3 players and knocking it in the top corner. You know, Ronaldo is gone, so they have to find another way to do things. And in fairness to Zidane, he's doing it.
Mm. That Italian grounding in the game you mentioned is very interesting, because I did want to ask you if we know more about Zidane's methods, if players have maybe over the last while talked publicly about how he shapes a team or what he does, or is he on the training ground every day drilling teams over and over, you know, Antonio Conte style, if we use the Juventus example. Because very memorably, I'm sure you're well aware of this and people listening will be as well, that Champions League final where there was a camera in the dressing room at half time, that spoke of a manager who offered very little tactical detail. I mean, in effect, from memory, he just told them there's space out wide, get the ball down the channels and swing in a few crosses. I mean, it was kind of like the escape to victory pre-match plan, really, you know, just whip it in there for Bobby Moore. So have we any sense of Zidane's day-to-day approach with the team and how hands-on he is in terms of drilling them over and over again? Or is this more of a kind of vague attitude?
Yeah, I don't think you're too far off. I'm not sure I'd use the word vague. What he seems to do, or from talking to the players, the little bits that people tell you, is that he is very simple with his messages, and it tends to be stuff like shoot more, or, you know, what, keep it onto your right foot, or, you know, don't cut back inside all the time. Just little messages like that people can take on board, because what he, and he, when he speaks to us in the press room, what he repeats again and again is that he thinks that Madrid have the most talented players in the world. And if they work as hard as the other team, if they concentrate as much, if they're as focused, if they don't make silly mistakes, then in the end, their quality will out and they'll win most of the games. So he puts a lot of concentration on their intensity, on physically being right. I don't think in training they do like Conte or like Klopp or Guardiola, where they have these moves planned where they all know where they need to be 4 moves in advance and they move around the pitch as a block. It's not so much like that. But they do all have to run really fast and tackle as hard as they can. And that seems to be, I don't know, that wasn't maybe Zidane's forte as a player, although he was a strong guy. He wasn't somebody who covered every blade of grass. But he wants his team to do that as much as possible. And at the moment, they're following him.
Gareth Bale, we should mention, if people are wondering, he was left out of the squad for the derby despite being fit.
Yeah, it's been another strange season for Bale and Zidane. I think they both, if they both could have found a way to move on last summer, they would have done, as maybe we've discussed before. Mm-hmm. Bale is still there. He did come back into the team in December. He played a couple of games since then, but Zidane has decided that maybe Bale doesn't give that 100% commitment, that 100% aggression. If he doesn't need him, then he won't use him. When players are injured or when there's a specific role that he wants for him, he will put him into the team. Mm. But yeah, their personal relationship hasn't improved, it's fair to say.
Okay. Well, it's all very interesting what's going on there, and Manchester City fans will be interested to hear about the new Madrid they'll be facing in the Champions League. I'm sure Liverpool fans listening in are very curious about the state of play at Atletico. Certainly at the Bernabeu at the weekend, Real Madrid fans were singing and encouraging Diego Simeone to go nowhere. They now, you know, they love him. Atletico are in fifth place. It seems like things aren't quite clicking. I'm reading reports of maybe a feeling Simeone's time at the club could be coming to an end after eight unbelievable years. And that maybe is the point, that he has set a standard which is very, very difficult for Atletico Madrid to continually meet. So what's going on there? They're in fifth place. They're 13 points off Real Madrid.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I'd agree 100% what you say, that Simeone has done an amazing job at Atletico and has set a bar that is, you know, is almost impossible to meet every year. They made a huge effort over the last couple of years to try and win the Champions League, especially last year when they had the Champions League at home at the Wanda Metropolitano here in Madrid. Kept a lot of their older players and spent a lot of money on other players to try to have the best possible team for that day. That didn't work out. Ronaldo intervened in the last 16 with a hat-trick. And then last summer, a lot of those guys left. Griezmann went to Barcelona, Godin, Felipe Luis, Juanfran, the old defenders, they all left. Mm. Guys like Rodrigo went to Man City, Lucas Hernandez went to Bayern Munich. They basically had to rip out their team and start again. And the rebuilding process hasn't gone so well. João Felix, he spent a lot of money on him. He hasn't been able to perform inside Simeone's system. He's injured at the minute. They have a lot of injuries. Kieran Trippier, the England right back, he was injured. He just had a groin operation just today. The news came out about that. We aren't sure what was up, why he missed the game at the weekend, but he's going to be out of the Liverpool games as well now. So a mixture of most of their best players leaving and those that they still have being injured means that it's the worst season of Atletico, of Simeone's time in charge of Atletico, for sure.
Okay, so it's a fairly simple answer to the question, but no easy solutions for Simeone. So that puts Liverpool as really firm favourites for that game.
Yeah, like when the draw was made, you know, Atletico fans were thinking, well, you know, Liverpool's run can't go on forever. They're bound to run out of steam at some stage, and maybe some of our newer players like João Felix will settle in, we'll get some of our guys back from injury. As time has gone on, the weeks have gone on, there's been less optimism over that, and you're talking about a miracle at this stage. Some kind of Atletico have had some bad luck in Europe over the seasons, you know, losing to Madrid in those finals. They hope that something might go their way, but at this stage they're hoping for, you know, act of God or something is the only way that you can see them beating Liverpool.
And Dermot, what has Simeone's demeanour been like in the midst of all this? We know he's pretty much the highest paid manager in world football, probably one of the reasons he has stayed there despite undoubted offers to go elsewhere. He has seen the new stadium being built, so there was a sense that this was a club really going places. But when your actual team is asset stripped, that's very demoralising. So his demeanour, his reaction to all this, and also the other side, I presume the club still want to keep him. They can't blame him for this crisis.
Yeah, the club, the president of the club and the chief executive and everybody 100% want to keep him, because he's the screen that stops everybody looking to see what's really going on behind the scenes at Atletico. Or if he were to leave and it was to fall apart, they'd be in big trouble. Simeone himself has, because he's an Atletico fan, he was there as a player in two spells. He really does love the club and he has a real connection with the fans and with some of the players who have stayed. In public anyway, he's been very, I wouldn't say upbeat, but he's at least put on a brave face on it. He spoke last week just before the derby about how he stays awake at night. He can't sleep thinking about what team he's going to pick. He's tried different tactical setups. He still appears to be giving everything to try and turn it around, to try and make the best of a difficult situation. He does occasionally remind people, I think, that, you know, Atletico's real rivals should be Valencia, Sevilla, teams like that, rather than Madrid or Barcelona. Over time, that's maybe not so much the case, because their budget is now a lot bigger than Valencia or Sevilla. They're kind of have moved ahead of them, even if they haven't caught up with Madrid and Barca. But Simeone doesn't give the impression of somebody who's going to go somewhere, but you wonder, you know, does he think maybe should have gone to Chelsea before? Or you look at Inter Milan this season where Conte is, that's another of his former teams. Conte's had money to spend and has a new broom there. It would have been an opportunity for Simeone. But as you say, he gets really well paid at Atletico. He likes life in Madrid. He's got a young second family that he started here with his second partner, and don't see him going anywhere for the moment anyway.
Okay. Meanwhile, a check-in in Barcelona. They're 17-year-old wonder kids doing things. So tell us about this guy. I was watching him on YouTube. He looks really special, I mean, for his age. I know he's the youngest scorer in the club's history. He scored against, I think it was Osasuna. He was still 16. And, you know, Wayne Rooney emerged as a 16-year-old built like a man in many respects. This guy, you know, when he's walking off a pitch next to Gerard Piqué as a 16-year-old, he looks 16. But they've never been a place where you had to be a giant to fit in perfectly well. He looks really special.
Yeah, he's a super talented kid. He took his goals really well at the weekend. He maybe gone off the boil a little bit over the last couple of months. The weekend was super. Like when he arrived on the scene in September, scored that goal against Osasuna, everyone was like, this is amazing. Mm. It was a big run by the Spanish Federation to make sure he was qualified to play for Spain because he was born overseas and spent most of his life in Spain, but they wanted to make sure that they got him for the Spanish national team. Was in and out of the team maybe under Valverde. Since Setién has come in, possibly because he's got few other options with Luis Suarez injured and Dembele injured as well, he's turned to Ansu Fati. But he's clearly a guy for the future. They don't want to burn him out. Maybe they want to try and hold on to him because he is so young. And as you say, he is physically, he's still growing. He still has to mature a lot. Connection with Messi is really good. Messi set up both of his goals at the weekend. And you can see with Messi that sometimes when players come into the team, whether youngsters or even big money players from other clubs, you wonder whether Messi rates them or not. You know, sometimes you think, why isn't he passing the ball to, whether it's Dembele or Coutinho, or why isn't he trying to pick those guys out? Whereas with Ansu Fati, you get the feeling that he is looking to put him into position, that he trusts him, that Ansu Fati can read what he's going to do, and then Messi can play the ball into his path. Another connection between Messi and this guy Ansu Fati is that Messi's brother is his agent. So the Messi family have a stake in him succeeding. But that just shows you as well that they've earmarked this guy as somebody who is the real deal. Whether it's asking a lot for him to win games at the minute, and maybe they're going to have to rely on him in the Champions League with all the injuries. But long term, he's the best player to come out of La Masia. You could say maybe since Messi, the best attacking player to come out since Messi, is fair to say.
Yeah, okay. Ansu Fati, two goals in their 2-1 win at home to Levante in La Liga on Sunday. As for Quique Setién, they lost 2-0 away to Valencia, I think, before the weekend. So we had Miguel Delaney on when he was announced. Miguel had sat down and done a big interview with him for The Independent maybe 18 months ago. Very impressed with him. This guy seemed to come across really well. Obviously, philosophically incredibly aligned with Barcelona, maybe without the CV to match, although as we know Barcelona don't necessarily go for big name managers when they hire him. So early impressions, Dermot, of how he's handling that step up to a global super club?
It's been really interesting to watch it. I was at that game at Mestalla and listened to him afterwards, and he's still struggling a little bit to get his ideas across to the players because Miguel has written about it, and it came across in what a lot of people have been saying, that he's a true believer. He's a radical, sticks to his ideas and really believes in that this is the best way to play football. And if you keep playing this way, then you will win. And, you know, that has worked out for people like Guardiola before at Barcelona. But he's still, it's one thing to be able to talk that way and to galvanize players. And at Betis and Las Palmas, he had a certain amount of success and had some big one-off results, but ended up losing. The fans at both of those teams ended up getting a bit frustrated with his obduracy or his obstinacy in always trying to play the same way, even when the circumstances were more difficult. And they had some bad defeats, and he ended up being fired from both of those jobs. Mm. So we're still going to have to see. It's difficult to come into any club mid-season, especially at Barcelona, and especially if you're trying to introduce this new philosophy or to change what the players are doing. Some of the players seem to have taken to it. Busquets has been very complimentary of him. Messi seems to be on board from what we're hearing. You look at others like De Jong in midfield, he just seems unsure of what he's supposed to be doing. And when Setién was asked about it, about De Jong, he kind of stopped a little bit and said, well, you know, it's difficult sometimes. Maybe it's my fault for not being able to explain properly what I'm trying to do, or maybe he just hasn't taken it on board yet. I'm sure he will. He's a very talented player. And all of that is fine, but Barca don't have very much time. They're slipping behind Madrid in the title race. They've got Napoli coming up in the Champions League in a couple of weeks, who are coming into some decent form themselves. So, you know, everybody loves Setién when he was unveiled, or most people did around the camp now. A lot of talk about Johan Cruyff and the philosophy and getting back to their values. That's all well and good, but if results don't follow pretty quickly, if they start keep losing it when they go away to Valencia, then they're going to be in trouble. And they're back at Setién's old club Betis at the weekend, where there's a lot of people who will be happy enough to beat him again. So that's going to be a very interesting one to watch on Sunday.
Okay. Well, they're 3 points off Madrid at the moment. And as you said, Napoli to come in the Champions League on the 25th of February. Manchester City will play Real Madrid on the 26th. City are a tricky team to talk about at the moment. Even the game on Sunday isn't a reflection of what actually happened. They're 30 shots to Spurs' 3. And it looks like a comprehensive 2-0 defeat. So against Real Madrid, a lot of us haven't seen much of Madrid. La Liga has kind of almost gone out of the general ether since it's gone off Sky Sports in some ways. Do you make Madrid favourites to go through against City, Dermot?
Again, I'd be similar. I'd see a bit of City, but wouldn't be watching them every week, whereas I'd be at the Bernabeu. And the feeling here is that Madrid are just coming into form at the right time, and that, you know, everybody, especially around Madrid, likes to see Guardiola doing not so well, really, at the Bernabeu. They're happy enough to see him slipping. So when Mourinho was able to beat Pep at the weekend, as Zidane was able to beat Simeone, there was a real feeling that this game is just coming around at the perfect time for Madrid, that they're clicking into form while City, maybe the wheels are coming off a bit and they've got some players back from injury. But just the narrative or the momentum at both clubs is going in different directions. So from here in Spain, Madrid are seen as pretty big favourites to be able to knock out City, which, you know, they'd be delighted about.
Okay. Just one last question, given that you've been over in Madrid for a couple of years now and covering football for many years. The Madrid derby, where is this if we have some kind of a spectrum of the Merseyside derby, which is traditionally quite friendly and you might see blue and red jerseys side by side. And if at the other end of the spectrum, we have Celtic Rangers. Where are we in terms of hatred? What's the nature of the Madrid derby?
It was somewhere in the middle, I'd say. It was up until before Simeone arrived, Atletico hadn't beaten Madrid in a derby they went 13 years, I think, without winning one derby. And Madrid used to just laugh at them. They unveiled banners with wanted a dignified rival to play against. Since Simeone came back, and with Simeone's personality and everything, much more of a bite came into it. Atletico fans were more proud of themselves. They put it up to them. Madrid didn't like losing to them at all, and were able to lord it over them for the Champions League games. But there was still quite a testy kind of rivalry to it. But you don't get too many fans. Like, there was 80 official away supporters at the game at the weekend. Like, there's more than 1,000 police and security and all at the game. There's big security around it, but there's very few away fans, and they're up in one corner of the ground. You're trying to make as much noise as possible, but you don't really hear it. A bit because of the culture in Spain is not for not so many away fans to be there. So it's not that different from another home game, really. You know, fans really want to win it. The home fans really want to win it. They're more up for it. You know, they really enjoyed taunting Simeone, as you mentioned earlier on, before it. But compared to a Rangers Celtic or a Liverpool Everton, the atmosphere around the stadium, even compared to a Clásico, maybe just because it's got such a global focus, or maybe the Clásico, you feel it's a bigger event than the Derby. But Saturday was... Madrid were very, very happy about it, and they enjoyed the victory, but you didn't have the feeling of a huge event either inside the stadium or around it before or afterwards.
So just 80 away fans. Yeah. I know there's not that tradition of away fans. I just thought, look, it's a big country and fans don't want to travel, but for the derbies there'd be more. So the allocation was 80, or could more fans have gone if they were bothered?
In theory you can apply for more than that. Maybe up to 1,000 or so, like the away end. I'm just thinking of what normally happens at the Madrid games. But Atletico fans, they just don't want to go to the Bernabeu to see it. It doesn't really come into their heads. The people who traditionally might have gone also would have been maybe more of the hardcore supporters, and they're on the out with the authorities. There's been a clampdown on ultras culture, whether the people are violent or not. There's been quite a clampdown on them on getting the chance out of the stadium because of some of the unsavory stuff that people have been saying. I do remember that the one derby that was was amazing, really, was the Copa del Rey final when Atletico won at the Bernabeu in 2013. That was half and half in the stadium because it was a neutral ground for the Bernabeu. And that was amazing. The Atletico fans, they took it over. They won the game in the end. Mourinho got sent off. Ronaldo got sent off. Simeone won. It was a fantastic occasion. But that doesn't generally happen. The idea of coming over and taking over your fans' ground and winning at it, which, you know, in Everton will be delighted if they got to do that at Anfield at some stage, or Celtic or Rangers will be delighted as well. Doesn't happen so much in right, between okay. Atletico.
And okay. Madrid. Very, that's very, very interesting. And very last one. Traditionally, like the makeup of the fans, obviously Franco and you know, the monarchy, you associate with Real Madrid. Is it like a working class thing, Atletico fans versus the elites of Madrid, or is it all a bit of a mishmash at this stage?
It's quite a mishmash. Like, the current king is actually an Atletico fan.
Right, okay.
The new king who came in a couple of years ago. I think, well, his dad was a Madrid fan, and maybe it was like a balancing act that they decided, whether for whatever reason, that he was an Atletico fan. But it's funny, if you try to watch a game in the center of the city, if you're looking for a football-related bar, you'll often find that there's more likely to be Atletico scarves behind the bars. Or the Madrid have a lot of fans all around Spain, and more than something like 30% of all Spaniards identify as Real Madrid fans. Inside the capital, inside the ring road, or the Real Madrid part of the real center of Madrid, you probably find more Atletico fans than Madrid fans historically. Over time, lots of kids follow Ronaldo or Sergio Ramos or whatever, so it's diluted, and it's basically 50-50 now, I'd say, amongst young kids. But whereas outside Spain, you know, in Ireland, I guess there's a lot more Real Madrid fans than Atletico fans, or in America or Dubai or wherever. But in the capital for the game, I guess maybe going to the stadium is not the best place to see that rivalry. If you went to your local neighborhood bar, you might get 50-50 and get a bit more of a ribbon going on, or a bit more slagging going on. But so Atletico, they hold themselves pretty highly up in that regard.
Okay, the true Madrid fans almost, yeah. Listen, Dermot Corrigan, as ever, a pleasure of independent newspapers. Thanks, Dermot.
Cheers, Joe. Enjoy it.
Paddy Power. As much a part of Irish football as hoofing it up to Johnny Walters.